content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin with an article today titled "The Mother of Soul Food" by Taryn White. Edna Lewis did more than anyone to elevate Southern food to haute cuisine. Some children are obsessed with soldiers, dinosaurs, princesses. Edna Lewis grew up in love with food and the land that yielded it. I loved walking barefoot behind my father in the newly plowed furrow, carefully putting one foot down before the other and pressing it into the warm plowed earth, so comforting to the soles of my feet. Lewis wrote in her seminal 1976 cookbook, The Taste of Country Cooking. On some occasions, the plow would expose the roots of a sassafras bush, which Lewis and her father would take back home to brew tea the next morning. Planting season was always accompanied by the twilight arrival of the whippoorwill, repeating breathlessly and rapidly, she recalled on another occasion. For Lewis, the birds, the quiet, flowers, trees, gardens, fields, music, love, sunshine, rain, and the smells of the earth were her muse and would play a large part in her ascendance to the heights of American cooking as the grand dame of Southern cooking. Born in 1916, Lewis was raised in Freetown, Virginia, a farming community co-founded by her grandfather, who had been born into slavery. There were no local schools for black children, so Lewis's grandfather hired a black teacher from Oberlin College in Ohio to tutor young Edna and the youth of Freetown in the living room of his white log and clapboard house. From an early age, Lewis learned to forage, hunt, and prepare a variety of dishes, such as newly dug sweet potatoes and crisp shad roe. One of her childhood duties was gathering wild berries, greens, nuts, and mushrooms from the surrounding woodlands. But she also learned fancy continental recipes from women in the community, many of whom had spent time 130 miles up the road in Washington, D.C., working as cooks and preparing French-influenced cuisine for their employers, says Karen Sherry, senior curator at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. For centuries, French cuisine was considered the epitome of fine dining in the Western tradition, Sherry notes, adding that these recipes were crucial to young Edna's culinary development. Amid the Great Depression and the Great Migration, Lewis moved north by herself at age 16, finally settling in New York, where she first worked as a laundress. But she had no experience in ironing, and that first job lasted just 3 hours. Her sewing was strong, though, and she spent a brief period as a seamstress. She even crafted one dress for Marilyn Monroe. During this time, she married Stephen Kingston, a cook with the U.S. Merchant Marine. The couple would have no children, though Lewis would later adopt an adult son, Afiworki Paulos, from Eritrea. In 1948, Lewis, with Carl Bissinger, a photographer, and Johnny Nicholson, an antiques dealer, opened Café Nicholson, a French-inspired restaurant on Manhattan's east side. As one of the era's few black female chefs, Lewis quickly became famous in the city, and the café became a haunt for the likes of Gloria Vanderbilt, Tennessee Williams, Paul Robeson, and Salvador Dali. Lewis blended French and Southern cuisine, preparing fried oysters, Virginia ham, filet mignon, and chocolate soufflés. The novelist William Faulkner once asked Lewis if she had trained in Paris and was shocked to learn she had never left the United States. Lewis left Café Nicholson in 1954 to pursue other business ventures, which included running a pheasant farm with her husband, working as a caterer and culinary teacher, opening a restaurant in Harlem, and teaching for a decade in the African Hall at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. A proponent of locally sourced food, long before it was fashionable, she would go to great lengths to seek out only the most genuine and freshest ingredients. When a broken leg forced her to stop cooking and confine Lewis to a bed in the late 1960s, she began to put her recipes down on paper. This unexpected time off allowed her to compile the Edna Lewis Cookbook, co-written with Evangeline Peterson and published in 1972. 4 years later, she released The Taste of Country Cooking, working alongside editor Judith Jones, who had collaborated with Julia Child. These books would establish Lewis as a champion of Southern cooking and an enchanting storyteller. Lewis's second cookbook was a bestseller, catapulting her onto the national stage and motivating other American chefs to embrace Southern food and to honor seasonal local ingredients. It has been reprinted 23 times and saw a revival in 2017 when it shot up the Amazon bestseller list after a 2017 episode of Top Chef, in which contestants prepared a dish in homage to Lewis's philosophy of food. While writing cookbooks, Lewis sought the help of her sister Jen to recall the flavors and cooking techniques of their childhood. On trips back to Virginia, she would try out recipes while staying with Jen, who lived on a farm close to where they'd grown up. Lewis's niece, Nina Williams Mbengue, then a young girl, assisted Lewis by typing out her handwritten notes. Part memoir, part cookbook, The Taste of Country Cooking presented vivid stories of the seasonal farming and harvesting traditions of Lewis's childhood and of the Black South more broadly. The American culinary industry had long treated European foods, particularly French cuisine, as the standard for quality. Now Lewis introduced the world to the deep delights of authentic Southern cooking. She helped to legitimize Black and Southern foodways, says Joanne Hippolyte, curator of record for foodways at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Thanks to Lewis, high-end restaurants across the country now serve mouth-watering Southern dishes with the seriousness previously reserved for continental dishes. What's more, Lewis's first two books were among the first popular cookbooks to give rightful recognition to their Black author. In earlier books on Southern cooking, some white employers documented the recipes of domestic workers without giving credit to their Black cooks. Hippolyte says, "The modern farm-to-table movement has roots in the work of Black farmers and chefs like Lewis, with their attention to fresh seasonal ingredients. By introducing the world to a refined version of Southern food, far beyond biscuits and fried chicken," she says, "Lewis's work has helped correct misperceptions that African-American foodways are inevitably unhealthy." Michael Carter Jr., a descendant of Freetown co-founder Robert Ellis, is a fifth-generation farmer in Orange County, Virginia, and the founder of Carter Farms, where Lewis's sustainable approach reigns supreme. Having tilled some of the same Virginia soil as Lewis, Carter in 2020 converted a portion of his family's farm to agriculture, an organic agriculture practice that he founded based on growing African crops and following Lewis's principles of local sourcing. A self-described farmer activist, Carter says, "Well before becoming a popular movement, farm to table was a way of life for Lewis and this community." He credits Lewis with inspiring current efforts to diversify the U.S. agricultural supply chain by depending on small local farmers. Like Lewis, Carter also educates the public about the Black roots of American cuisine, giving lectures about agriculture at places like Virginia State University, in which he examines the contributions that people of African descent have made to food and farming, both domestically and internationally. Lewis continues to inspire today's culinary celebrities, including James Beard Award-winning vegan chef Bryant Terry, who considers her a muse. In his most recent cookbook, Black Food, Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, released in 2021, Terry declares that his book is grounded in the work of Chef Edna Lewis, who celebrated local cuisines with seasonal ingredients. Other chefs inspired by Lewis include Mashama Bailey, another James Beard Award winner, who is a restaurateur and serves as chairwoman of the Edna Lewis Foundation, and Kwame Onwuachi, also a James Beard Award winner and restaurateur, who in 2021 launched the Family Reunion, an annual celebration of Black cooking and contributions to the food industry held in Loudoun County, Virginia. Throughout her career, Lewis constantly moved between the South and the North, serving as chef at Fearington House in Pittsboro, North Carolina, Middleton Place in Charleston, South Carolina, and Uncle Sam's Steakhouse in New York. In 1988, at the age of 72, she became head chef at the landmark Brooklyn restaurant Gage and Tallner. Under Lewis's guidance, the 109-year-old eatery transformed its menu for the first time in more than a century, adding items like corn pudding and pan-fried quail. According to a Newsday profile, Lewis would visit Union Square Market every morning before dawn to purchase produce for the restaurant. Nearly every year, no matter where she was based, Lewis would travel back to Orange County to reunite with her family and church, especially on holidays like Emancipation Day. When she returned to the North, she would always make sure to bring back jars of summertime preserves or pickles to be savored on a chilly winter day in New York. In the early 1990s, Lewis decided to hang up her apron and move to Georgia, where she forged a remarkable friendship with Scott Peacock, then the head chef at the Georgia Governor's Mansion. Often described as the odd couple of Southern cooking, Lewis and Peacock became close, and in Lewis's declining years, Peacock served as her caretaker, even co-writing her last book, The Gift of Southern Cooking, Recipes and Revelations from Two Great American Cooks. Published in 2003, the book showcases the two chefs' distinct styles. There are recipes for skillet cornbread, caviche, and turtle soup. By the time Lewis died in 2006 at age 89, she received every major accolade in the culinary industry offers. Lewis was officially named a Grande Dame by Les Dames de l'Hospitalité Internationale, won the first ever James Beard Living Legend Award in 1995, was awarded an honorary PhD in culinary arts from Johnson & Wales University, and received lifetime achievement awards from both the International Association of Culinary Professionals and the Southern Foodways Alliance. She is also only one of five American chefs who have appeared on a U.S. stamp. In her native Orange County, a recent menu trail guided visitors to seven restaurants serving meals based on Lewis's recipes. Offerings included smothered braised rabbit at Vintage Restaurant, roast quail stuffed with wild rice and white grapes at Spoon and Spindle, and a classic apple Brown Betty at both Gordonsville Ice House and Clearwater Fire Grill. In these ways, Orange County is bringing history into the present while honoring the woman who changed perceptions about Southern food and African American foodways, as Sherry says, and her unique and powerful voice that combines love, history, and a strong sense of social justice. Right until the end of her life, Lewis maintained her deep, almost mystical reverence for nature. As she wrote in Pursuit of Flavor, "Perhaps it is because of the natural, undisturbed compost that nurtures them year after year, or perhaps it is because they grow only where the soil, light, and humidity are right for them, but wild things never fail us." Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Authentics by Javier E. Pinero. Artists in Puerto Rico resist modern trends to preserve the truth of native culture. After living in New York City for a year, I decided it was time to go home to Puerto Rico. I had grown increasingly worried that the island's unique art forms and crafts, which draw on centuries of Caribbean, African, Spanish, and American influences, or in danger of disappearing. Upon my return, I collaborated with artists and artisans for 2 years, documenting their daily lives and how they work to keep traditions alive, educate others, and reconcile the indigenous and modern worlds. One of the greatest threats to the island's artistic heritage is the recent exodus of residents. Since 2010, some 500,000 Puerto Ricans have left, a population decline of nearly 12%. The exodus, prompted by Hurricane Maria and the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as diminished services and rising rents, includes many artisans and artists, but the cultural impact goes beyond even that. Because a large number of the immigrants are young, the passing of local knowledge from experienced practitioners to the next generation is imperiled. The risk is cultural amnesia. The title I've given my project, Survive by Few, refers to people working to conserve specific Taíno, Native, and Afro-Caribbean ideas and techniques. Some people produce work using the same materials and methods, long favored by indigenous artists. Others find ways to blend ancient and contemporary approaches. What they share is passion and persistence, a lifestyle that cares for everything in the surroundings, and a commitment to saving a beautiful creative force from extinction. Alice Chaveres has conserved Taíno techniques in their purest form. Her workshop, Talar Cabochuelas, located in rural Torrechillas, was founded in 1984 by her mother, Evarine Chaveres. Her fabrication process involves harvesting clay from the surrounding areas and burning it on the ground with wood instead of a kiln. She keeps a binder full of Taíno designs for when she offers workshops to school children and others. On one of my visits, a family of artists who had traveled from Massachusetts to learn from the artisan used the archives to create various pieces. Chaveres has taught several hundred people in schools, seminars, and workshops. I asked about her practice. At first, it was difficult to understand why these techniques came naturally to our family, to me. When I was a child, everyone constantly pointed fingers and asked where we were from. Even in my household, the idea of being Taíno, was looked down upon due to the derogatory idea behind the indigenous. I soon understood that the Taíno blood is my blood, and that these techniques represent us. They were here in the beginning. Her pottery embodies a reverence for the land itself. Earth is our provider, Chaveres said. We are to blame for the holy ground's condition. When I only take what is necessary, not in excess. If a piece breaks, I return it to the earth. From earth we came, and to earth we will return. Since 1905, in Ciales, Puerto Rico, the Villalobos family has created traditional furniture with unique weaving and braiding techniques. Their firm, Hibaro Furniture, makes use of hardwoods and cattail. I was introduced to the Villalobos through Jorge Gonzalez, a Puerto Rican artist who works closely with them. With his help and that of others, I also had my first experience harvesting cattail in wetlands on the island. It is done early in the morning, and the stalks are set out to dry in the sun for days or weeks, then picked for braiding. The braiding process can take anywhere from 6 hours to 2 days, depending on the artisan's level of experience. The wood that the family uses includes oak, mahogany, majo, and laurel. For years, the family would access open lands and harvest wood for use. These days, they purchase lumber, sometimes receive donations, and occasionally cut down trees themselves. The three active family members, Guadalupe Villalobos, Juan Luis Villalobos, and Waldemar Villalobos Colon, all have separate workshops. There's a healthy rivalry among them. Guadalupe's Tu y Yo designs is perhaps the most acclaimed. It features two rocking chairs constructed as one, allowing those sitting it to face each other. The rocking chair is bonded by its armrest. Guadalupe does square braiding, a technique he invented. In the beginning, recalls Guadalupe, the eldest, we used to have more than 10 families working on the furniture, around 50 family members simultaneously. Villalobos artisans previously frequented artisan fairs and offered seminars, but lately they have found younger people are not interested. It's a very demanding job, and no one wants to be working early in the morning, sweating in the field, says Juan Luis, who is open to sharing their technique with others. In contrast, Guadalupe says it's important to keep the special skills in the family. I interviewed several of their grandkids. They said they cherished the tradition, but obtaining a degree and following other passions were more important. Producing beautiful and long-lasting furniture teaches us about caring for land, autonomy, and self-sustainability. But after more than a century, it seems the Villalobos' celebrated local knowledge is endangered. Considered one of Puerto Rico's oldest musical and dance styles, bomba was born from enslaved Africans transported to the island by the Spaniards. Since its beginnings, seemingly in the late 16th or early 17th century, the art form has been used to share stories and has more than 30 rhythms, thanks to interactions from Taino and European musical traditions. Ensembles are composed of a percussion section that includes two or more drums called barriles de bamba, bamba barrels, a maraca, an instrument first made by the Tainos using a higuera tree, and a cua, stick drum made from a hollow bamboo log. During a performance, a dancer enters the drum space and challenges the player of the high-pitched drum to follow and mark his or her steps. Bamba is more than just a musical entertainment. Our ancestors used it to communicate collective suffering, among other emotions, and by powerfully asserting their presence, denounce their oppressors. Traditionally, the barril de bamba is made out of rum barrels and goat skin, but on a visit to the island last year, I documented the making of a drum out of a royal palm tree by the master artisan Rafael Trinidad. In New York, I met Marian Torres Lopez, director of Taller Tambuye, a nonprofit she founded to benefit Puerto Rican youth. The group has held bamba performances and workshops on the island, but also in Mexico, Venezuela, Spain, France, the United States, and the Caribbean nations. In the recent past, performances were typically staged for audiences, but Tambuye, which means drum player, has returned to the art form's roots and aims to get people out of their seats to engaging with the music. Torres says Tambuye has taught the art form to over 8,000 people worldwide. The movement has grown especially with young people, what she calls the Bombazao generation. We know that not everyone will try to deepen their understanding and preserve the essence of bamba with purity, but from every 100, a few get back to us with the intention of conservation, Torres said. Any way you look at it, that is valuable. Next, we'll move on to a science article by Brian Handwerk titled, Our Human Ancestors Very Nearly Went Extinct 900,000 Years Ago, Genetics Suggest. For 75 years, the doomsday clock has been a powerful metaphor, representing how close humanity is to extinction from threats like nuclear weapons. Currently set at 90 seconds to midnight, the clock suggests that we are closer to catastrophe today than at any time since its 1947 debut. But had the doomsday warning mechanism been around 900,000 years ago, it might have estimated only a single second remained before midnight signaled the end of humanity. An intriguing new genetic study suggests that our ancestors dwindled to just 1,280 breeding individuals during that era, and they nearly vanished from the earth long before modern humans even appeared on the scene. The study, published at the end of August in Science, analyzed the genetic lineages of 3,154 modern humans to trace their characteristics backward in time and model the population patterns likeliest to have produced their existing genomes. Wang Jihu of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and a colleague suggest that between 813,000 and 930,000 years ago, the population of ancient humans that would eventually give rise to our own species, Homo sapiens, experienced what geneticists call a bottleneck. For unknown reasons, perhaps difficult environmental conditions, their numbers plunged dramatically to a point where our lineage was within a whisper of total extinction. Based on the study's estimates, some 98.7% of our human ancestors were wiped out. The estimated population size for our ancestral lineage is tiny, and the bottleneck lasted for a remarkably long time, if accurately modeled, says paleoanthropologist Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London, who wasn't a part of the study. If the bottleneck did occur, it would certainly have brought our ancestors very close to extinction. The geneticist suggests that the bottleneck may have led to an increased inbreeding and a subsequent loss in human genetic diversity that has persisted to this day. They also theorize that the bottleneck may have given rise to a new notable hominin species. The timeline of the bottleneck matches some existing genetic estimates pegging the same time period as when a new hominin appeared that may be the last common ancestor of the later Pleistocene's three Big Bang species, Neanderthals, Denisovans, and ourselves. University of Wisconsin-Madison population geneticist Aaron Ragsdale, who wasn't involved in the research, says the study raises some very intriguing questions about human evolution during a time period from which both genetic and fossil data are relatively scarce. I'm eager to see if their results are replicated using other methods, Ragsdale says. Amazingly, the study suggests that our ancestors managed to survive in precariously small numbers for an extremely long time, an estimated 120,000 years. But when conditions again became conducive to human habitation, whether through beneficial climate shifts or, as the authors theorize, technological advances like human control of fire, our ancestors bounced back swiftly. By around 813,000 years ago, all 10 African populations in the study appear to have increased by a factor of 20 times. The estimated bottleneck period is too old to yield any ancient DNA, at least with current methods. The study's author suggests this long period during which our ancestors survived in such small numbers may have led to the evolution of an entirely new species that may be the last common ancestor of modern humans and our close relatives, the Neanderthals and Denisovans. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.